I don't have a problem with chopping off my pinky. I think that'd be fine.
I know it. People are crazy. You're crazy, Chris. That's mutilation.
I broke this finger falling down the stairs carrying my laundry a while ago. It's crooked, so I'll give you half of it, like, right now. I'll do it literally right this second.
Just to prove us that he'll do it.
Welcome to Under Embargo, a podcast that cuts through the noise of the communications industry and gets straight to the good stuff. Hosted by Becca, a no BS corporate comms expert, and Perry, a PR agency founder with a knack for telling it like it is. This show is where strategy meets straight talk, from media relations and brand storytelling to navigating the chaos of modern PR. They're bringing unfiltered insights, industry truths, and an occasional spicy take. Whether you're an industry pro, a curious marketer, or just here for the raw and real, you're in the right place. No fluff, no spin, no corporate jargon, just Under Embargo. Now let's get into it.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us again to our second episode of Under Embargo. Today we have our very first guest, which is super exciting, and it's Chris Willis, who is the CMO of Axios HQ, where he helps companies cut through the noise and communicate what actually matters. He's been a longtime leader in B2B, SaaS, and AI, and he's built marketing, sales, and product strategies that fuel growth, drive pipeline, and make business impossible to ignore. And I will say, looking at Chris's background, he has a super interesting background. So I am excited to talk with you today, Chris. So welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. Well, you get to have the glory of being our first guest, which means you also get to have the glory of seeing the sausage making happening while we're trying to figure out how to do this whole podcast thing. But I will say you are a podcast pro, and I know this because I was on your podcast once.
You were. I think this is going to be fine.
Yeah, we'll be fine. The thing is like you are the expert and we know nothing. So maybe we just need to take advice from you. One thing I will say is before we started recording, and I had no plans of talking about this, but you said you produce all of your own podcasts. How?
I did.
Why? How did that start? Give me the story on that.
I had, several years ago, I had a production company, and the problem that I had with it was I have a very specific flow that I want. I want to start with a cold open. I want to go into me doing the introduction. I have a voiceover artist do the intro for the show, maybe drop in a commercial, and then into the body of the show. And I asked for that. And whatever methodology they were using to build my episodes, they just couldn't do it. And so I lasted one season in a shoe that didn't fit me and got rid of them. And so I use Riverside as my recording mechanism. And then I have to literally take all the video, audio, and content and put it into Premiere, Adobe Premiere, and do all the video production, audio production myself in there. I don't know how I got to that. And I would prefer not to be. I just finished season 6 of Word Birds. Wow. It was a 20-episode run. And I mean, it's hours a week
doing that work myself.
I'm fascinated by what you're doing.
From start to finish, how much time goes into the production of each one of these things? Like if you had to put a, you know, hard number on it.
So I find the person, I identify the topic. So with Becca, I saw a statement she made on LinkedIn about the challenges associated with getting communications jobs. And it was a topic that I'd been thinking about a lot. And so cool, I want to talk about this. From there, I need to put together a flow of the show. I'm not super good at just coming from on the fly. I want to have an idea of what I'm going to talk about. So I put together the questions that we're going to talk about. We could stick to those or we could not. It's just a framework. And then do all the outreach and scheduling and making sure that we're on the calendar. Then actually doing the show. Then I have to write all of the introduction content. I have to find and identify the cold open. So she's going to say something either aggressive or crazy. And I want to use that to start the show and clip up all that video and then do the production work. So, I mean, we're talking a half a day an episode at least, which did diminish over the course of the season because now I have templates in Premiere and I'm getting better at it. But it's time consuming. And when you try and put that against everything else that I have to do on a day-to-day basis, that starts to take up a lot of slack time that ends up pushing things out and extending my day. I love the idea of having a producer. What you're up to is fantastic. And I think probably I'm going to meet your team and talk about what season 7 is going to look like.
I don't think we could do this without a producer. Like I mean, I don't even just finding time to record in like a day in the life of a CMO is hard. So kudos to you, man. That is super impressive.
Well, and I'm wondering,
well, see, this seems like it's easy.
What has been the impact of doing the podcast so far? I mean, you're doing this about communications, which is pretty much what we're focusing on too. And I'm just curious to know what sort of some of the feedback has been, or have there been any like big learnings relative to Axios HQ and your whole sort of ecosystem?
So for us, it's really about the point of view. I don't talk about the product on the show. I don't talk about our company. The point of view that we have is that communications as a role is ascending. It's the same place that we were 5 years ago with human resources that moved away from being HR to being people and culture. And we're seeing that same shift now with communications and getting that seat at the table. And this was something that we were talking about right when I got here at the end of 2023 into 2024. And I didn't really have plans to do a next season of the show. But the purpose of that was, how do we talk about this with people that are experiencing this from all sides? Like, is what we're thinking happening actually happening? And can we get validation of that? And can we help to guide that? And that's really what's happened. I mean, interesting thing, just a cute little stat, is that of all of the topics, crisis communications, number one episode with a bullet. I talked to Roberto Munoz of Munoz Communications. He was CCO at Fannie Mae and HSBC about crisis communications. That episode is head and shoulders above everybody else because, again, actionable content about things that people are dealing with, and it's helping them be more successful in their job. And each episode after that, that was episode 2 of the season, has followed on that. Like, how can we be actionable? How can we make sure that you're going to learn something here that you can take back? And that's the part that I like, is that in every conversation, like I'll use Becca as an example, she walked us through how she built her following on LinkedIn. I can do the things that she's saying, like maybe not the way that she does it and get the same impact, because I'm not getting the same impact. I need to come back to you on that. but that allows, I leave that conversation with an action item list. And that's what I'm hoping that listeners are leaving with, is that same action item list of things that are going to make their ascent in communications better.
That's kind of the whole point of content, right? Is like, give people a value add and something that they can take and make their life better. You said that the Crisis Communications podcast was the most popular, and that's super interesting because I also think crisis communications is what driving comms is getting gutted all over the place, but then there's a crisis and a company's like, oh no, we need comms, right? And that's the thing that then drives companies to hire a comms team again, or a chief comms officer or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's all crisis driven. And I wonder if that is part of the reason why that episode is such a hitter also, is just crises seems to be the thing that then sets in motion, oh, comms is important again.
Absolutely. I mean, I think where I'm trying to get people from a thought process standpoint is that comms isn't the tactical outpost that you thought it was. And I think that's why it's easy to cut, to be fair, is, I've asked that person to send an email and they've done it, but you know what? I can send that email. That's comms through the eyes of many CEOs. Right. And the evolution that we need to make is from that tactical to strategic. Show your work, show the value, think about the end result. Who are you communicating with? What are you communicating? What happens if they don't listen? Because there is a downstream impact of communications that doesn't get the press that like the downstream impact of the marketing organization and their lead creation gets, that is just as important in driving the business forward. This is an alignment role. This is a business leadership role, but we don't know that when we fall into comms at 26 years old out of college. I'm going to put stuff on the billboard, and I'm going to make sure that I follow the CEO's guidance and say the things. There's more to that. And that's the word that needs to get out. And that's the process that we need to build and the steps that people need to follow.
So I want to follow up on something that you said when you were talking about the podcast that you do, which is that you wanted to see if what we think is happening in comms is happening, get sort of validation or contrarian viewpoints about that idea. What is happening in comms in your view? Like, if you take a step back and look at the whole industry, what do we think is happening? What do you think is happening? And I guess the logical follow-up is, why is that thing happening?
So the best comms organizations, the best leaders are attaching to a business problem. An example that I really liked that I heard from my friend Joanna Parsons, who I'm sure you both know, was that when she was going through the UK's communication, government communication team's goals for the year, the goals weren't send 300 emails. It wasn't create a great all staff. It was find a way to generate, did they do gallons or liters? Some huge volume of blood donation. Yeah. Like, their end goal was a objective tied to value. And if that's where you start, then you're valuable to the business. If that's not where you start, if your objective is we're going to do 25 all staff emails this year and we're going to have 3 town halls, you're not going to get very far, because eventually people are going to be like, you don't have to. That's actually not that important.
But like, this then makes the argument that comms needs to be in the room from the beginning, right? Because if mm-hmm. we don't know what we're trying to achieve, how the hell are we supposed to achieve it? And I think this is a huge breakdown in companies where we're saying, oh, we need you to write a press release. Oh, we need you to write an email. Oh, we need a campaign about this. Why? What are we trying to accomplish other than like drive more revenue? Like, yes, we know we want to sell more stuff, but for this, what is this activity driving towards? What is the outcome we're mm-hmm. trying to drive? And I do think, to your point, it needs to go, comms needs to understand that. And then they need to speak in the terms of the business to say, this is how we're driving those outcomes. But on the flip side, the business needs to include those teams from the beginning in both an advisory capacity and as far as making sure that they understand, that they know if we do X, Y, and Z, we're going to get A, B, and C. If we're not there, we don't know. And then we can't drive the outcomes because we don't even know what we're trying to do. And we're just going to go and do the stuff that we've always done because we got to do something, right? And I think that's what I see all the time. And that's why comms is getting belittled and called the can you just pretty it up team.
Absolutely. I mean, a very real life example of not thinking through what you're here to do. I can't quote who it is, but I can say that it's a police department in a major US city. I was talking to their lead communications person. They have a team of 3, and they were thinking about efficiency in their team and making themselves better and faster and getting more out of this small team. And nobody cares about that. Like, that's not the thing. When you look at what they're doing, like those same questions that I just asked of who are you communicating to? What are you communicating? What happens if they don't listen? Ask that over that team. They're communicating with police officers on the street. What are you communicating? Policy, legal updates, things that they need to know so that they don't arrest the wrong people. What happens if they don't listen? We make the press and we get sued. Okay, that's what you're here to do. I don't care. I mean, we can make you more efficient. I have products and solutions that will make you more efficient, but it's not about your efficiency. It's about achieving that end goal. Like, if you can save your police department $10 million this year in legal defense fund, who are you now? Like, what is your department here to do? Because that's exciting. And you may already be doing that through the work that you do, but if you don't know that, if you're not connected to that outcome, then neither is anybody else. And it's all going to be lost. And somebody's eventually going to say, we don't need 3 people. We only need 2. And totally. Some of that value is going to go away and nobody's even going to know why.
I think a lot of what we do is like, we're creating value and then we're not telling anybody about it. Like, it's hard. And, you know, I think people notice when comms is gone, because suddenly it's like, oh, nobody did this thing. And it's like, yeah, that's because the comms team was doing that. And they just weren't telling you about it, because we're doing 900 things that people don't know about. But to your point, if it's not the thing that is moving the needle for the big goals of the business, at the end of the day, you're going to be the first person on the chopping block. So that is outcomes-based everything, but we need to know what outcomes we're trying to drive.
I think it's true for, so I'm on the PR side. I own a PR agency and I'm not internal comms, but I think it's true for both comms people internal to a company and external PR, in the sense that everybody in that industry really sucks at advocating for themselves and proving out their own value. I think that, you know, for people who are so great at making other people shine and elevating other people, we are desperately terrible at doing the same for ourselves, whether we're internal or external. And I guess that leads to a question for you, Chris, which is, how do you sort of advocate for the role that you've championed at Axios HQ? And, you know, what's the reception to whatever activities that might be?
I mean, it's about corporate alignment and productivity. Like, it comes down to it. And let's, I mean, specifically around internal communications, but you could expand this to external as well. It's about building a better organization. Everything runs better when people know. One of our customers, Cox Communications, prior to really thinking through their process, adopting Smart Brevity, all the things that we do, had measured alignment with corporate goals very low within their organization. They felt that 62% was a low number of staff that know why they're here. Like, what are we here to do as a company? And when you put effort and intent into your internal communication process, you're able to drive that number up. And in their case, they saw that go up like 20% in the period of time that they measured it. Who cares? Like, okay, so a lot more people know what we're here to do. Well, that's productivity, that's project times, that's engaged employees that stay, retention, reducing the cost of replacement, all of these things that come of the alignment that communications as a function in the business provide. And again, to Becca's point, like, yeah, it doesn't matter. Nobody really knows what they do. If you don't have that level of engagement, alignment, positive culture in your business, you're going to pay for it somewhere.
But it's like, so hard to measure. Like, that's the problem. Like, and it's Perry's problem too. Like, in the PR seat, it's like, the outcome we're trying to drive is this, and we got an awesome media hit. How do those two things, like, what is the delta between those, and how does one impact the other? It's really hard for us to show that, even though we know that it, to your point, is impacting the culture, the retention, the ability to hire, all of those things, but we can't prove it to the finance guy to say this thing caused this thing. So how do we, what do we
and
do?
And that is why comms needs a seat at the table, because when you have that seat, when you have that representation at the top of the organization, you're getting the feedback on all of the things. This isn't, it's not a communication role. It is that concept of alignment, of understanding all the things working together. You have to have that top-down view so that you can identify the places where alignment is having that impact, because you can measure retention. You can measure project time. So seeing a reduction in project time aligned with an increase in overall engagement and alignment is something that, you know, again, somebody at a manager level is not going to be able to see. You don't have that data. But somebody sitting in the executive board or in the conference room in the exec team is going to have that visibility of like, hey, why are all these things happening? Here, let me do some quick looking. Oh, look at this number and look at how it relates to this number. And this is through the alignment that we're building in the organization. We're creating a better, more streamlined business that works better together, because everybody knows why they're here. Everybody knows what we're up to. Everybody knows what the goals are. This communication isn't just for fun. It's not just because people are like, you suck at communication, you should tell us more. It's not a curiosity thing. It's a cost of doing business.
I cannot agree more. I even as somebody who sat in the C-suite, I find that my favorite is like, why does brand matter? Why does that leadership matter? Who cares if the employees feel happy, right? And it's just like, all of those things matter. All of those things impact your bottom line, but because they can't say, this communication led to more engagement and therefore fewer employees quit, somehow those activities don't matter.
Yeah. Just to chime in there quickly, I feel that there is a disconnect, generally speaking, between typically it's the CEO and what happens in comms and PR generally. Like the CEO is really more in line with the CRO or the CFO relative to, for them, they care about at-bats, lead flow, like what's the pipeline look like, and everything else that isn't easily, tangibly sort of one-to-one is easily dismissed, right? So I think that's a challenge. And I think against that backdrop, we're entering into obviously the age of AI. And you use the word efficiency, Chris, and I think that's what is interesting as we move into middle of 2025 and 2026 is what does AI do to further exacerbate or not what we're talking about here, which is having that seat at the table, proving the value, or is AI going to essentially say, you know, we're taking over your job because the CEO doesn't view it as critical? A bot can do it.
I mean, it's interesting because obviously like my product has AI features in it, but it's still the thought process of how all these things work. So I'll go back to what you just said. Yes, CEOs align with my metrics as a marketing leader. Like I want to know what kind of leads are flowing through the funnel. I want to look at conversion rates and all of these things. But I will tell you that it is challenging to get an organization or even a leadership team around that data. And that's something that our communications organization in my company right now, this is not hypothetical, helps to align. So we had last year our own weekly updates to the CEO and executive team. And our communications team came in, did a huge audit, aligned us around two weekly newsletters that we do where we report all of our revenue and numeric data, and then all of our action items around projects. Like they did that. They made this consumable so that I can have a higher confidence that my CEO is seeing the right things from my organization because somebody has come in and said, you're blinding us with information. And that comes back to the whole point of like, there's too much. There's too much going on inside companies right now. There's so much message. There's so much communication. There's email, there's Slack, there's Teams, there's SharePoint, there's all of this stuff. Whose job is it to say enough, let's make this consumable? And so that connection between the things that your CEO cares about, the CFO data, the CRO data, the CMO data, and the CEO, that's that alignment role. That's that communications person that says nobody understands what you're saying. Like,
so is this the
argument? Done too much to make it easy.
Is this the argument for a chief communications officer in the C-suite, or is it the argument for some new role that isn't quite well defined that people are starting to create right now?
I mean, that's interesting. I mean, we think of HR differently when it's not HR. We think of HR differently when it's the chief people
experience
officer.
Team or whatever.
Yeah. Right. Do we think of internal communications differently if it's the corporate alignment team or whatever you would envision it being called that gets more to the point of what it's there to do? Internal communications is brownies on Friday. Corporate alignment is keeping our business together. And maybe it's nomenclature. Maybe it's just we're calling it the wrong thing. And if you call it the wrong thing long enough, people start to believe that it's the wrong thing.
Or it's just we're changing. Like the role of the communications leaders is changing, right? And what people used to we used to have a PR person, right? And now there's like a whole swath of comms people within an organization who all have very distinct different roles. And I think maybe we're evolving to a place where, where we need to like redefine what communications is to a business, because it's not just one of those things. It is this like highly multifaceted function that somebody who does internal comms does not have the same skill set as somebody who's doing PR, right? And we shouldn't just expect that one person is doing all of those things, because that they're not even driving the same outcomes. They're not even supposed to be driving the same outcomes. They have completely different goals. So I don't know. I could talk about this all day.
But
good.
It's absolutely a corporate overlay role, right? It's over everything. And in a way that no other department is, like the fingers of communication are touching every part of the business at every level in the business. And if that's the case, then envision it in 3D. It's the mesh that wraps your business. Like, and to say that that's not important enough to keep in the business during hard times, like, when do you need it more?
Exactly.
You need it when everything's awesome.
Exactly.
I feel like you need it now.
Yeah, I think that there's a PR and communications, our whole world, unlike many other functions, is something where we are constantly having to educate people about what we do, why it matters, and how the various pieces within it are different than the other. So for example, when people think about communications, many people, and this is not hyperbole, think it's really just like there's a person internally that writes a press release and pitches it to the media. They think that's what communications writ large means. They think that's what PR means, even though PR is really just one piece of an overall communications program, and pitching the media is only one small piece of what PR is. It's like this Russian nesting doll. But no one's able to just say that once and have it be heard and understood. You have to constantly sing for your supper and sort of revalidate your very existence, which is just the bane of our whole lives. And I think that's not going to change.
It's so much of our job too. I mean, I tell people that 30% of my job historically has been just explaining the value of my team and what we do here so that people will respect us and not just be like, oh, well, you wrote a press release last week, so you guys are the press release team, right? And it's like, really? Okay, finance team, you made a spreadsheet last week. Are you the Excel team? No. Like, oh my God, why? How is this? It's just a fundamental lack of understanding, and I get that, and I need to be less frustrated by it. But considering I've spent 15 years with 30% of my energy just explaining to people what my job is, like, you would think at some point the business would start to say, you know what, more people need to understand this. Maybe business schools would like to talk about communications or talk about the value, the business value of alignment, right? Who does that? Mm-hmm. If we're not doing that, who's doing that?
Well, I got good news for you. If you're listening and you don't know, Becca just took a new job as a CMO. So if you thought you were done explaining to people what you do and the value of your team, I have bad news. You're just at the beginning of a whole new journey.
That's a really good segue, because one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is you are a CMO. You are not a communications person, but you work at a company that is all about the communications person. So you understand the value of comms. How do you as a CMO help to elevate the communications function within your company now or in the past? You've been a CMO forever. So tell me about that, because so few CMOs do understand the comms value in the real nuanced ways that they should.
Full circle moment. You talked about crisis comms being the thing that gets people to care. That's been my job for 20 years. I have also owned communications inside most of the companies that I've been at. In fact, this is the first company that I have been at that I don't. And so the criticality of managing the message, of making sure that people know what they need to know, and being the voice in the business, has been something that's fallen to me, which, as I made the shift to HQ, made all of this make sense right out of the gates. Like, when I met this company, I knew that this was something that I wanted to do, because it's something that I understood in a unique way that I don't think I would understand every job. If I was going to go work at a cybersecurity company, I would need to learn some things about cybersecurity. But walking in, I get what we're up to. And I understand the value, and I know how to elevate this role. And it's organic for me. I don't have to put this on. This isn't a show that I'm doing for your audience right now about how I think communications is important. I live this. I spend a lot of time with our comms people. I spend a lot of time with our communications leader now that he's on board, friend of yours, Sean Garrett. And I think that's, it is exciting to be in a position where my primary point of view publicly is the elevation of this role, because it makes me better in whatever role I'm in.
So can I kind of, speaking of the CMO piece, ask you a related question? So there's been an online debate in the past, I don't know, couple of weeks from CMOs, marketers talking about how some people are rejecting the role of a CMO as it relates to today's world, which is much more predicated on lead flow, more like a CRO type thing. Have you seen this argument? And there's a lot of people like, you know what happened to, you know, the importance of brand? Like, brand was the magic thing that all marketers aspire to, right? To get that halo effect, build that halo effect on your brand. But instead, it's the marketing function in some people's view is being pushed more toward the bean counter role, like pipeline, brand be damned. Where do you come down on that, I guess? And, you know, that's very much putting you on the spot. That's a pretty big question.
Spare my feelings.
No, I mean, I have a great point of view on that. So I'm not a marketer by education. I have a theater degree from a liberal arts college. And I fell into this when we started a company back in the 90s. And the room spun. 90s. I'm very, very young. I was very young at the time. But the room spun and I became the marketing person. And I didn't know what that meant. It just was somebody took the president role, somebody took the technology role, and somebody took the customer success role and left me with marketing. And I think any of us could have done any of those things, but that's the way that it worked out. And so now I got to figure out what this means. And I very quickly, to your point, figured out that it meant I need to fill a pipeline. That's how I get my budget. I like telling stories. I like creating messaging, but nobody pays you for that in most businesses, and especially in the type of businesses that I've been in, because I've been SaaS and startups, and we're not at a point where having a brand would do anything for us. We need to generate leads. Where this gets interesting is where you can be good enough on the demand side to be able to do those other things and prove the value of, for instance, a strong brand. One of my favorite stories was that in, I don't know, 2013 timeframe, we had a company called Pixis Mobile. We were the first package mobile application company. We built a platform that would allow you to build mobile applications that would run across iPhone, BlackBerry, Android devices by configuration, not by build. It was very individualized. And in 2014, we set out to change the name of the company to align the name and the product and the business that we had become. And what I hoped would happen is that we wouldn't see any headlines that were Pixis changes its name to Verivo. Like, that's not what we're doing here. We're building a stronger business. And so the day that we announced, I watched all the media and they reported the story that we wanted them to report. Cool, good. We're not getting shit all over, which is fantastic. That's what we hoped. But the proof was in the Gartner Magic Quadrant. We went up and right, which, if you don't know the Gartner Magic Quadrant, that's the direction you want to go in. You want to go towards leader with high execution. We went up and right with no product release in between the 2 years. It was just based on brand.
I love that.
We created a better story that all aligned to create a stronger go-to-market and better belief in our business's ability to execute. That's what brand does. And so if you do it right, you're creating increased value in your business. And once you can prove that, like, once that's a thing, then you get the keys to the brand conversation.
Yeah, that's interesting. Go ahead, Becca.
Well, I was going to say, not to mention, what you're saying is it's a vessel to better tell your story and connect with people. But if there's 900 companies that all do the same thing, brand is also your differentiator, right? Brand is also the thing that makes people care about you, right? Why would I buy from Perry and not from Chris? Well, I like Perry better. Sorry, Chris, right? Like,
that's it.
It really comes down to that. And I don't really like Perry. but that's, it really matters. And when I talk to people all the time about, like, building a personal brand online and how I did it, and 90% of it is like, I just show up in a way that is authentic and people vibe with that because they're like, oh wait, that's real, right? And that's why they follow me. It's not because I'm selling something better. My product isn't better. They resonate with the way that I show up more. And it, like, the idea that that doesn't matter in sales is insane to me. Like, to your point, like, the brand itself made a huge impact on the business. Nothing else really changed. And I love that proof point, and I'm going to use that a million times in the future because I think that is such a great example. In job interviews that I've had, when I'm telling people about brand stuff, I tell them the story about when I worked at Aludo, which I was hired to build a parent brand that sat on top of a portfolio of companies. That parent brand sold zero products. I had to build a brand and then sell that brand. That is a really interesting thing, but it goes to prove that like you can't, a brand can exist without the whole demand revenue thing if you need it to. So anyway,
I think about it. So, you know, especially when you're talking about a crowded competitive field and people are trying to differentiate with features and functionalities and checkboxes and this kind of stuff. And that was how I came up in the PR world, basically, was in the SaaS world with like a CRM thing, fighting against like the Salesforce's, Sales Lofts, like everybody doing the same stuff. And every 2 weeks we'd put out a release about like, you know, this widget we announced, and we'd book 15 meetings. And they're like, oh my God, they have this widget. And then people would say, wait, we had that widget first. And no one ultimately cared about that stuff in the final analysis. Salesforce beat the hell out of everybody because they created a movement that people wanted to rally behind and be a part of. It was an existential shift in the way people talked about SaaS, about CRM, about Salesforce automation. And Mark Benioff was the guy that had the magnetism swirling around the whole thing he did. He was like a media magnet. People needed to be in his presence to interview him. And that was brand, 100% brand. Even though, in my view, the company that I represented, which was called Upshot, which was sold to Siebel for $70 million, had a better product. It didn't matter. Benioff just kicked our ass and everyone else's ass because he had the brand. So
I mean, think about the two CRMs that are left. Like, think about when we were younger, how many CRM systems there were competing in this space. And now there's two. Like, I'm sorry to all the ones that aren't HubSpot and Salesforce that are still out there, but I don't know who you are. I know two. And the things that they have in common is the brand that they built and the community that they built around it. And that's really interesting because if that's the things that you can do well, that blows the whole demand gen argument out of the water. You've created a sustainable business based on people's affinity for it. I look at what Mike Volpe did at HubSpot. When I first heard about HubSpot, it was because my investors at the time said, you need to buy HubSpot. I don't know what it is. What does it do? We don't know, but everybody's buying it because I'm in Boston and they're in Boston.
So I bought it. I launched HubSpot with my agency when we were in San Francisco.
HubSpot is a one of my company's portfolio companies, guys. Yeah. Look at us. All of us look connected here.
Yeah, I should say, HubSpot, but my agency did.
But what I bought didn't even do anything. Like they'd sold to all these companies on very little product set. Their MVP was nothing. It was a blog platform. Yeah. But now they're in the door and they're starting the beginnings of that buzz around inbound, and then aggressively grew that message, stuck to it. And it's, I mean, we use HubSpot today.
CRM, right? Like if you're a small company, you use HubSpot.
There's two CRMs. And again, sorry to everybody else. I'm sure there's more, but I don't know who you are.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Dharmesh Shah, the founder of HubSpot, is now all in on agents, like AI agents. He's got a platform called Agent AI. And every day he says one more thing that blows my damn mind about what these agents are able to do, which is why it's kind of funny. I was thinking the other day, like, everybody's aggressively building an AI world that is going to replace a whole lot of the people that are building the AI that's going to replace them. And they don't even realize it yet. They're whistling past the graveyard.
Are you doing with AI right now? You must be doing stuff.
Well, we're working with a bunch of AI clients, and we also use AI for sort of simplistic things in our agency. So, for example, we use like Fathom as an example to take notes for the things we do. Like, we use a handful of tools, and sometimes we'll use AI tools to do like a little bit of ideation to get us started thinking about new ways of looking at things. We'll sometimes get a skeleton of like, here's what we think a byline could look like, but we're 100%. I shouldn't say 100%. We're probably 90% human as we do all the writing and put the meat on the bones. But it really is about sparking beginnings of things for us with AI.
I mean, I don't love, because of where I've been and what I've done my last couple jobs and this job, I don't love the idea of creating content with AI. I think that there is a human aspect to content that's necessary, but sitting where I sit with a calendar that is a solid block every day, the ability to build a relationship with, I call him Chad, but it's ChatGPT. It's just easier to call him Chad. And have conversations like a person and build out, you know, ideation around things that I can turn into something in a matter of minutes versus taking a half a day to do the same things that I used to do. Like it's remarkable how much it fast tracks, but yeah, to the point of what you just said, it for me isn't replacing anybody. It's just it's putting me in more places. Yeah. I'm getting prep for meetings. I'm getting ideas on how to synthesize messaging to create a better outcome. Like it's just making things faster for me. So I have like my assistant, my strategist, my content creator, all living in this environment, having these ongoing conversations that I've been having for like the last 2 years. Yeah. And my favorite thing to do, and if you're brave, you do this, is you go to wherever you've been using, whether it's Claude or Chad or whoever. And the prompt is, based on all the conversations that we've had and all the things that you know about me, tell me something you don't think I know about myself. Oh, mind fuck.
I do this one for sure. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. I mean, my Chad knows me very well. Like I'm never not using, I pay for ChatGPT, Claude, and Google Gemini right now because I'm kind of testing use them for different things. Like what's interesting is I find myself going to one for certain use cases. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to break myself out of that and using different ones for the things I wouldn't normally, just to see, because they're changing so much and so often that what was true 3 weeks ago may not be true anymore for that same foundational model or whatever. And I just, I don't know if you guys have played with, now ChatGPT allows us to do 10 deep research things a month. Yeah. If you have a paid, I have been digging into that. And that is the shit that is mind blowing. I mean, the agentic stuff, when agents will be running all of our things, I can't wait for a lot of that because my ADHD brain, like that will make so many things in my life easier. But the research piece of like, you have access to all of the information ever in the world, and this is what I need an answer for in this format. Like that is badass. I almost dropped an F-bomb and I held myself.
I did deep research today before we got on this podcast about Chris. So I used deep research and I started going down a rabbit hole about CrossFit.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a thing.
Turns out Chris is a big CrossFit guy.
Tell us more, Chris.
Yeah, what is going on with you and CrossFit? You seem to have a very advanced role in that industry.
I am an elder in that cult. So cult. It's funny because I'm reading a book called Cultish right now. It's about the language of cults, and they don't get through the first chapter without mentioning CrossFit, and that's fair. But in 2013, I was a bigger gentleman, and the developers in my company had a annual Biggest Loser weight loss competition, and you throw in $100, and if you lose 10% of your body weight in 3 months, you get a share of the whatever's in the pot. And they came to us, the exec team, and we're like, you guys want to be in this? They figured we would throw in $100 and walk away. And something clicked in my head, and I was like, I'm going to destroy these kids. And what I know now, and I'll come to why I know this now in a second, I starved myself for 3 months because I don't want to play if I don't see results. I want to see a pound a day. Like, so I'm going to like hot yoga and elliptical and like rubber suits, and I'm not going to eat. So I ate vegetarian chili 3 meals a day for 3 months, and I lost like 70 pounds, and people cried. Like my PR agent at the time walked into the restaurant that we were meeting at, and I just saw the tears start. And she's like, oh my God, are you okay? And I was like, no. And she's like, oh my God. I'm like, I'm kidding. I'm on a diet. Thank you though. This is the best thing I've ever heard.
And are you dying?
When it ended, like, yes, I won. I lost a lot of weight in a very short amount of time, very unhealthily. But now what do I do? And this was 2013 when everybody you knew was like, you should try CrossFit. And I'm like, I should definitely not do that. That sounds terrible. And I want to have nothing to do with it. But again, desperation, I walked into a CrossFit gym, and I did not know things about myself. I did not know that I am more athletic than I thought. I did not know that I am more competitive than I thought. And I really liked what I was learning about myself. And it is absolutely the definition of a cult, but it's a good one. And the people and the relationships that I built in the gyms that I was at, and that's what keeps you going, and the progress that you see, and it's very data-driven. So my day job, being a data-driven marketing leader, now my activity, I've got all of the things, all of my fundamental lifts in my phone, and I know all of my WOD times, and I measure over time, and I can see, I can tell you every Fran that I've ever done and where it started and where it is, where it was at its best, and unfortunately where it is now. Cause
I don't know half of the words that you're saying right now.
What is a Fram?
Who's Fram?
That's again, cultish, the book, Language of Cults. We have our own language. So Fran is a workout. It's 21:15:9 of thrusters and pull-ups. You're supposed to do it as fast as possible. So when you think about a workout, you think about a 30-minute Peloton ride. Most people do. This is a...
I think about Bed Angels.
Well, fair. For elite athletes, and I am not one of them, Fran is a 2-minute workout. Two to do 21 thrusters, which is literally like front squat to overhead, and 21 pull-ups, 15, 15, 9, 9 in 2 minutes. I have a just sub 4-minute Fran time at my best in like 2018. But again, the tracking of that, the first time I did it, it took me 17 minutes. I got it down to sub 4. I'm living at like 6.5 right now because I'm an older gentleman. But those are the things that I liked about it. I ended up getting my coaching certificate. I ended up being the head coach of the gym for a number of years. I'm a level 2 coach now. So up leveling my skill set. It sounds a lot like a lot of other cults you've heard of. You get closer and closer and closer to the middle. And now I'm at a point where that's where my friends are. Like, honestly, that's where I go for my social time. That's where I see the people that I don't see at work or in my house.
I think there are worse things than being aligned with a bunch of healthy ass people. That's probably not the worst thing.
At least you're not there, like,
I mean, there's some weird, confusing downsides too, but yes, that like last night, one of my CrossFit friends dragged me to Hot Pilates, which I, in my head, I thought was going to be like hot yoga. No, within 5 minutes, my abs seized up. I cramped and I collapsed. And then I spent most of the rest of the time just sort of gently sobbing, but you couldn't tell because the room was heated to 110 degrees.
I always hear that from men who do Pilates. I mean, I don't do anything because I don't exercise. But whenever men say they go do Pilates, it's like this, I just ended up in the corner crying because I wasn't expecting it to be what it was, which is hilarious.
I can do really horrible things with a lot of pain involved during a workout, but that thing last night, that beat my ass down.
That's so funny.
Crazy.
I will say though, the gamification thing is everything right now. Like I show up on LinkedIn because I gamify my thing. So, you know, for those of us who are driven in my case by dopamine, things like that, data that allows you to like level yourself up and constantly be tracking whatever is totally the motivator in my world. So I could see how you would get sucked into that cult for sure.
Well, I can tell you about a nice thing that you can join. I'll look where you live and I'll find you a fantastic CrossFit gym, introduce you to the people. You'll
it's love time it. To wrap this up, I think.
now that I've moved into recruiting stage.
I tease. I'm the same way, but just with golf. I'm like a golf fanatic and I am constantly measuring, refining my game because that is an absolute passion. And fortunately, it provides exercise too in the form of walking like 6 miles every time you play, which is nice. Yeah. So I get to not really suffer when I play golf.
And you get to talk to people. I mean, both of you have this sport that is very social also. And I think that's a huge piece of your cult there.
I think that is true.
Okay, since we are running short on time, and I promised that I was going to create rapid fire questions for our podcast so that we can ask all of the guests, I don't know if this is going to stay. This is our first podcast with guests. So,
It's going to stay.
Okay, so we have 4 minutes, and I want to make sure we get through some of the good ones. So I'm going to go in a random order. If you get to erase one corporate buzzword from existence, what is it?
I put it in a slide today. Synergistic. It just makes people sound like an asshole. I don't know.
You are a synergistic asshole. So there you go. Okay. You are about to give a presentation in front of 50,000 people. What's your walkout song?
So many good songs by Kanye, but we can't do that anymore. Shake It Up by Manchester Orchestra. Now, you might think that that is an actual orchestra. It is not. It's a fantastic rock band.
There you go. All right. Next question. You get to use one emoji for the rest of your life. Which one?
It's definitely the eye roll, followed by the grimacing face.
Those are two of my top five.
Same.
For sure. I think we are all cut from the same cloth. So this one is from Perry.
Okay.
You can either have hiccups 24/7 for 3 months, or you have to chop off your pinky and you have to do it yourself.
I don't have a problem with chopping off my pinky. I think that'd be fine.
You know what? People are crazy. You're crazy, Chris. That's mutilation.
I broke this finger falling down the stairs carrying my laundry a while ago. It's crooked. So I'll give you half of it. Like right now. I'll do it literally right this second.
Just to prove us that he'll do it.
To prove a point. My head of product is a knife maker, and I just got one of his knives sent to the house, and it's here, and I can zoom out right now.
I'll tell you what, we would instantly get a lot of views. So I'm all for it, Chris. Go ahead.
We're going to go viral here. Chris is going to chop off his pinky, ladies and gentlemen. Amazing. Okay. This is going to be, probably the hardest one. If you had to do a TED talk on anything but marketing or communications, what would your topic be? Although maybe it's CrossFit.
I mean, you kind of gave it away, but I think it's probably that thin line between fitness movements and cults. Finding friends after 40, I think is probably.
I would totally watch that TED talk. I think that's fascinating. And I do think there's a lot to the fitness culty thing and the psychology of cults. So fascinating. All right. Since we have 1 minute, I'm going to give you the last question. What's a myth or misconception about communications that drives you crazy?
That the best comms can do is hang up posters and drive culture. Comms is a business driver.
Amen.
Oh, mic drop.
I know. With that, I don't even have anything to say. Thank you, Chris.
I do have one quick thing to say, which is that yesterday I did a blog post or 2 days ago about if you are asked at the end of an interview, what didn't I ask you? Or do you have anything final to say? Have that mic drop moment. And I think we just had one right there. You are a man who has been in comms and knows how to do that. Nice work.
I guess we could ask him do you have anything you want to add though? Because that's fair.
I mean, I think he just added it, but you're welcome to.
We talked about work and CrossFit. I don't really have much else going on.
Well, there's the pinky and the knife thing, but we'll save that.
That's the next show. Yeah. We're going to cut off pinkies. Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you, everyone. Chris is from Maxius HQ, as a reminder. And we'll see you on our next show, everybody. Thank you for joining. And thank you, Chris. Adios.
Bye-bye.